American history didn't just take place on land. For hundreds of years, sailors shaped the industry, culture, politics, stories, and songs of a growing nation. This is Off the Path. I'm Davis Donovan. This hour, we'll be telling stories of those sailors, some of whom were law-abiding, and we'll explore why the ones who weren't, pirates, play such an outsized role in cultural representations of American history. They died on the gallows as pawns in international disputes. Famous religious leaders of the colonies fought to save their souls. And legends of their lost treasure, real or not, survive for centuries. Coming up next, we drop anchor with Off the Path, distributed by APM American Public Media. Essex, Connecticut is a town built on the sea. Even though it's technically a few miles inland on the Connecticut River, it was a center of shipbuilding in colonial times and the site of a British attack on ships in its harbor during the War of 1812. The whole town is awash in nautical history.
Essex was also a decamping point for people.
That's Joseph Morneau.
When they got over the sandbar at the mouth of Connecticut River, they would stop at Essex to get into smaller craft to go up to Hartford or wherever. So Essex was always sort of a hub, a maritime hub, be it sailing vessels, be it steam vessels.
Essex is also the home of the annual Connecticut Sea Music Festival. Joseph is one of the organizers. I've gone the last few years, and you'll hear a lot of songs you might have heard sung on ships in this harbor centuries ago. Most famously, sea shanties.
Most people think of them as, oh, you go to the bar and you sing and you pound your glass on the table. But shanties were created by mostly illiterate men as tools to use on a ship. They were used for work, for specific jobs, and sailors never sang them on shore.
Bound down Trinidad to look for sunny door.
I'm Jerry Bryant. I am a singer and amateur scholar of traditional sea music. I think everyone in the country knows the song Shenandoah. We learned that in grade school. You had to sing it in choir. That was a sailor shanty. That was created by sailors to do the work of raising the anchor from the bottom of the harbor all the way up and get it on board the ship. So they would march around singing Shenandoah. Now, it happens to be a gorgeous melody. Oh, Shenandoah, I long to see you. Away, you rolling river. You know, so some rough sailor came up with this melody, put words to it, and they used it to help get their work done.
The Connecticut Sea Music Festival came here in 2021 after decades in nearby Mystic, Connecticut. It draws hundreds of people every year. There's a lot of folks out there who like to sing sea shanties and other kinds of maritime music. I grew up in landlocked parts of Middle America, so I've always been fascinated by ships and the sea. That's part of why I like to explore spots from New York to Boston and beyond. Everything from quirky roadside attractions and weird oddities to places with deep historical significance. For the podcast Off the Path.
Did you ever see a wild goose sailing on the ocean? Ranzo, Ranzo.
Along the way, I met the Ranzo boys, Lafayette Matthews, Jules Pipehearl, and Lindsay Smith. We all kind of ended up part of the same community of people who regularly go to sea shanty festivals, like the one in Essex.
It feels like a secret world that you're like discovering for the first time.
That's Jules.
One of my favorite things about going to those events is being able to make friends with people from different generations.
Jules is in their 20s.
I feel like a lot of people that I know are only really friends with people who are their age, which is totally fair, but I learned so much from older folks.
Lafayette also started by learning from older generations at those smaller events.
There's one in Staten Island where there was a retirement home for sailors and where a lot of these songs actually were written down and recorded in the 30s, the 1930s. I would go and I would hear all of these songs and I began to learn what they were used for, how all of these songs came to be because of that interaction between sailors and cultures in the 19th century.
Later this hour, we'll hear stories of the sea, white whales, and of course, pirates that all shaped a growing nation along the Atlantic coast. And maybe it can also tell us something about our politics, culture, and industry we find important in America today. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. At the very least, it's what turned Lafayette, Jules, and Lindsay into lovers of sea shanties.
I specifically remember going to a sea shanty saying in Connecticut that was like in a huge space, and it was packed with people. And we were all singing these sea shanties, most of which I had never heard before. And it was such an incredible, like, just like a wall of sound and like everyone participating. And I had never experienced anything like that before. And so I was like, maritime music, I dig this.
My name's Kate Clifford, and I am I'm a singer, I'm a community enthusiast.
Moonlight, starlight, moonlight shines so bright.
They don't care if you sound good. It's not about sounding pretty. It's about having fun. It's about taking part in the living tradition of singing with other humans like we've been doing for ages and ages and ages. It gives me chills every time when I'm singing with these people. I can hear the centuries of people who came before us.
People have been singing aboard ships for longer than history keeps record. But most of the ones we know are from around the 1800s, which is when the whaling industry took over maritime commerce. And that's when we started to get what we think of now as sea shanties. Michael Dyer of the New Bedford Whaling Museum explains sea shanties came from men, and they were almost always men, aboard whaling ships and other vessels. They'd haul a bowline, which is the rope used to pull a sail. It's hard work.
You know, these are heavy jobs, and you'd need a full crew of strong guys, you know, all hauling on that line, and they had to haul in unison. And in order for them to haul in unison, you know, having a rhythmic work song that would keep them amused, as well as keep their keep focused on the job at hand, made the job that much easier. And it's a big part of culture. It's a big part of maritime culture for sure.
Or they'd push a capstan. That's a big rotating wooden device that hauls ropes and cables. Sailors had to push it hard, walking in a circle around it.
A really good shantyman could keep a crew working on time through these, you know, enormously heavy jobs. And it was very rhythmic, you know, away, haul away, we'll haul away together, away, haul away, we'll haul away, Joe! And you pull on Joe! And you do it every time until the job is done. And, you know, the classic, you know, what do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do with a drunken sailor? Early in the morning, you know, it's all the rhythm.
It was a hard life. In the 1800s, boats called packet ships crisscrossed the Atlantic. They were named for the packages, often mail, they carried back and forth from America to Europe. Sailors had a harsher name for them, blood boats. Amid the drudgery, the songs kept them going.
Apart from chattel slavery in the South, there's not a class of human beings in American history who were treated worse than sailors. These guys, they were out of sight, out of mind. The only time you saw them was when they were on shore, drunk, because they just came in from, you know, 2 years cruising in the ocean, and they hadn't seen a woman in a long time. They hadn't had any drink, and they didn't have any free time, and they came ashore, and they found the boarding house, and they found the tavern, and they drank themselves blind.
Michael says that bad behavior was mostly limited to shore leave. He says today we only remember the drinking and carousing. We don't really appreciate how important sailors were.
They're heroes, these guys. They are incredibly skilled people doing incredibly difficult work, day in and day out, carrying the immense treasures of the world from point A to point B, and successfully, for the most part, weather permitting.
These sailors were the commercial backbone of the nation for centuries.
When you look at the history of the settlement of New England, it is a maritime structure.
Settlers were pouring over from Europe on ships. In the 1600s, about 500 ships a year crossed the Atlantic from Britain alone.
This constant crossing back and forth across the Atlantic Ocean took place at the same time that the great Greenland whale fisheries were growing in the high Arctic. And so colonial America grew, and it grew in its most natural way to the sea.
Jules Piperl of the Ranzo Boys thinks about that every time they sing in a place that was a historic port.
Whenever we get to go to maritime spaces, like the town of Essex, Connecticut, a lot of those places have a lot of pride of they exist because of sea travel and ships. They care a lot about that being the foundation of their town, especially in New England, but all over the U.S. Sailing is their history, and so because they care about it, it is part of, like, the American fabric.
That's why sailors and the sea still feature so prominently in books and movies, like the Pirates of the Caribbean series.
Something that they do get at in Pirates of the Caribbean is that the romantic view of sailing is about freedom. It's about, you know, I think he says something like, bring me that horizon, you know, like you can, like if you're on a ship, and obviously this wasn't the reality of most sailors or even pirates' lives, but this romantic idea that if you're on a ship, you can go anywhere, you can make anything of yourself. That's a very powerful notion.
But as we get further and further removed from this period of history, we begin to lose those distinctions.
That's Jules's bandmate, Lafayette.
Sailors and pirates and, you know, yo-ho-ho, a bottle of rum, they all sort of meld together.
The golden age of piracy was the 1700s, and the golden age of sea shanties was the 1800s, which means that pirates didn't sing sea shanties, and that makes me sad.
I think a lot of misconceptions about the era come from maybe stuff that is quite wonderful, things like the art of Howard Pyle, or Treasure Island, or Pirates of the Caribbean.
Part of the reason that you get these misconceptions is because people are interested in the idea of going to sea and maybe starting your life over. It represents a way to get away from society and a place where, you know, you could reinvent yourself. And that's really cool. And why wouldn't you want to sing about that?
Coming up, we'll explore who pirates really were and the mark they left on history. This is Off the Path from WSHU Public Radio, distributed by APM American Public Media.
We could spend all day saying thank you to those who support WSHU with financial contributions. I'm WSHU reporter Desiree DiOrio, and one way I say thank you is by covering military and veterans news to help you stay connected and informed. Your financial support is the lifeblood of the WSHU newsroom. Thank you for making this trusted resource available to our community. We're expanding our world together.
I'm Davis Donovan. Welcome back to Off the Path from WSHU Public Radio, distributed by APM American Public Media. This hour, we're looking at how America's history and culture have been shaped by ships and those who sail them, including pirates. There's an illustrator named Howard Pyle who's shaped a lot of our images of pirates. One of his illustrations is heavily responsible for how we imagine one of history's most notorious pirates, Captain Kidd, famous for his rumored buried treasure. Pyle's picture shows Kidd looming over some treasure chests on a desert island. He's dark and sinister, holding a flintlock pistol and staring out suspiciously while his crew dig a hole to bury the treasure.
He definitely did have kind of like this legendary status.
That's historian Rebecca Simon.
He doesn't really fit the archetypal pirate we think of, like the swashbuckling, cutlass carrying pirate captain or anything like that. He was a socialite. He had married very wealthy, so he dressed very finely, which was actually pretty common for high-ranking captains like he was.
To be honest, I didn't know anything else about the guy. I just thought he went around burying treasure everywhere.
He was a privateer. He worked for the British government. And he had a very excellent reputation.
Privateers are kind of like state-sanctioned pirates. They rob ships for the government.
A privateer works by a contract called a letter of marque. And this is given to a privateering captain who gets a crew. And the letter of marque says, you are working for us. For example, in Captain Kidd's case, you are working for us, the British Crown. You are going to go to the Indian Ocean and you are going to be robbing rival ships.
So he was really a pirate hunter.
And you get to keep about 80% of all the loot you steal if you attack the ship, and the rest of it comes to us along with the other goods that we request. It's a very specific contract detailing very heavily what ship that they are allowed to capture.
Captain Kidd got to the Indian Ocean with his letter of marque.
The thing is, he's not having a good time in the Indian Ocean. They aren't capturing very many ships.
His crew got restless. They weren't getting paid, and they felt like Kidd wasn't keeping up his end of the bargain. One day, Kidd got in a fight with a crew member named William Moore,
who is saying, you know, there's a ship in the distance. Go capture the ship, or else we're going to commit a mutiny. And Captain Kidd calls him a lousy dog, and Moore shouts back, if I'm a lousy dog, it's because you've made me so. And then Kidd picks up a metal bucket and cracks Moore over the head with it.
Moore died of his injuries. Kidd insisted it was an accident, but his crew was ready to revolt.
In order to appease his crew, what he does is he decides to just start attacking any ship that comes across them.
The English government turned against Kidd and set off a worldwide manhunt for the man they now labeled a pirate.
So pirates are often capturing people's imagination, you know, these criminals sailing in far off places, getting money. We're always attracted to that sort of thing. People have always been attracted to crime and criminals and serial killers.
Captain Kidd's celebrity was propelled by rumors that before his arrest, he landed on an island somewhere and buried all the treasure he'd amassed plundering ships in the Indian Ocean. This recording was made about 5 years ago on a very windy day on the Long Island Sound. It's when I learned about Gardner's Island, just northeast of the Hamptons.
My name is John Edgington, captain of the schooner Mystic Whaler.
Captain Edgington pointed out the outline of the island as we sailed by on the schooner. It's privately owned, so we can't set foot on it. There's a lot of lore around it, including some about Captain Kidd.
Yes, there are. Quite a few places claim to be spots where Kidd buried his treasure, and they can document it. Gardner's Island is the one place I know of that Kidd actually acknowledged burying it. And he knew better, I believe, than to sail into Boston Harbor with a boatload of treasure. He wanted a bargaining chip. And so he buried his treasure on Crow Head on Gardner's Island. And with that, he sailed to Boston.
Captain Kidd didn't bury it in secret. He told the island's owner, John Gardner. He even gave Gardner's wife a length of gold cloth from India in thanks. Historian Eric J. Dolan says when Kidd left his treasure on Gardner's Island, it wasn't the kind of thing you might see in a pirate movie.
That's not the same as, you know, sort of leaving buried treasure and coming back for it. That's because he didn't know what kind of reception he would get in Boston from the governor. He was a labeled pirate, so he didn't want to bring the most valuable thing he had with him before he could get the lay of the land.
Kidd got back to Boston and found himself under arrest. He was shipped to London and found guilty of murder and piracy. And Eric thinks that was probably the right verdict, even if Kidd wasn't much of a pirate.
A number of people think he wasn't a pirate at all. It gets into the minutia of legal definitions. But whatever is the case, he wasn't really successful in doing what he was charged with doing.
And the trial is just, it's so nonsensical.
Here's historian Rebecca Simon again.
Kidd maintains his innocence throughout, and his crew speaks out against him. No friends would come forward like Kidd had hoped. So there were no character witnesses. Everybody abandons him and basically kind of throws him to the wolves.
Rebecca says Kidd's execution is basically public theater. He's led in a procession through the streets of London.
The head of the Admiralty is at the front of the procession carrying a silver oar.
They take him to the public gallows and they lead him up onto the scaffolding.
Kidd is so drunk he can't even really stand on the scaffold or speak. And so they hang him. And what's interesting is the rope breaks when they release the scaffold and he survives it. So then they have to do it again.
Captain Kidd's body was coated in tar and hung in full view from a pole over the Thames River as a warning to other pirates. It stayed there for at least 3 years. It was a grisly practice called gibbeting. And as for Kidd's buried treasure on Gardner's Island, the rumors of it had already spread on this side of the Atlantic.
The idea that someone had buried or hidden a huge cache of coins and gold and jewels, this, of course, hits the newspapers, spreads like wildfire, and people immediately try to start searching for it. And to this day, people are still looking for it.
There's a song about Captain Kidd. It's from 1701, the year he was executed.
My name was William Kidd, as I sailed, my
That's the Ranzo Boys singing. Lafayette Matthews of the group says the song is what's called a broadside ballad.
And what that meant was there's a guy who's watching Captain Kidd on the gallows in order to tell this news, the great privateer Captain Kidd has been executed. He's going to write down everything that he's hearing, and he's going to print it, and he's going to sell it all over London and all over the countryside for a penny.
I sailed from sound to sound as I sailed.
Back in Boston Harbor, there's another pirate who met a similar fate. His name was William Fly. I'm looking out into the harbor on a brisk, windy day with Park Ranger Patrick Boyce.
And rising above the water is a very, very small, almost invisible island known as Nix's Mate.
Patrick points it out to me. It's so small that it's almost entirely covered up at high tide, but luckily we can just make it out right now.
It's no more than an acre at low tide, and it was famously a place where the ill-fated pirate William Fly was displayed after his execution in Boston in 1726. If we were here when William Fly was being displayed out there, what would we have seen? All ships coming into Boston Harbor would have passed that one particular spot. So the first thing you saw would have been this body displayed in a cage coated with tar. Welcome to Boston. Don't engage in piracy, because this could happen to you.
So just like this slowly rotting body?
Exactly.
Captain Fly's gibbeting marked a historic turning point.
So William Fly is a British pirate, and his fate kind of exemplifies the end of the golden age of piracy, a period of roughly 40 years where pirates really ran rampant throughout the Atlantic world. And Boston was a touchstone for a lot of them, a place to offload their ill-gotten goods.
There was a broadside ballad written to mark Fly's hanging, just like with Captain Kidd. It emphasizes how he seems to have just popped into history one day, sailing with Captain John Green on board the Elizabeth, a slave ship bound for the coast of Guinea.
William Fly was a pirate bold, but his birthplace is unknown, I've been told. All that is known, Captain Green, ship Fly as boatswain, but in that capacity, he didn't long remain.
William Fly leads a mutiny on the ship the Elizabeth that results in the death of the ship's captain and his first mate. Their bodies are chucked into the water, and the other mutineers decide to elect William Fly as their captain. They sew themselves a Jolly Roger and rename their ship the Fame's Revenge. Now, instead of going to the west coast of Africa as originally planned, the now renamed Fame's Revenge goes on a bit of a rampage up the eastern seaboard.
Fly and his crew captured four or five ships along the way. In one case, Fly took out his aggression on the captain of one ship by tying him to the rigging and lashing him. And then he sank his ship. See, Fly and his crew weren't that interested in the ships themselves. They wanted what was on board.
Tobacco, logwood, enslaved people, anything they could sell somewhere else. Which is in part and parcel why they're coming to places like Boston. It's a place that will buy their ill-bought and wares.
Every time he captured a ship, Fly forced the crew to serve him. It's called impressment. For example, he forced one guy named William Atkinson to be his navigator. Eventually, all those unwilling and probably unhappy sailors outnumbered Fly's original crew. You can do the math, and guess what led to Fly's downfall.
And William Fly kind of falls for the oldest trick in the world. William Atkinson, who is acting as this pilot, he's looking through a spyglass. He says, oh, look, I see some sails on the horizon. And William Fly replies, well, I don't see anything. And Atkin says, look, stand where I am and look in that direction. Well, Fly does so, leaving all of his weapons unsecured, which are then seized by all the other impressed sailors who now make William Fly their prisoner. And they are brought back to Boston.
William Fly's spree of piracy only lasted about a month, but his arrival in Boston was a big deal. Pirates weren't just a problem at sea. All their money and power was starting to make them influential on land, too.
Piracy was an enormous concern in the colonial world, and that pirates exerted enormous power, able to blockade the harbors to major cities, able to make alliances with royal governors, and really act as a thorn in the side of traditional authority.
So here was a pirate, literally tied up and presented as a gift to Boston's colonial leaders. They decided to make an example of him.
But William Fly and the three other pirates are tried, convicted, and sentenced to hang. Now, back in colonial Boston, the real public event to see would be a pirate execution. That was the big popular event that could attract hundreds, if not thousands, of spectators.
The spectacle got the attention of a local pastor named Cotton Mather. He was based at Boston's North Church, but his notoriety went far beyond that. He was one of the most famous men in colonial America. He's still thought of as the archetypal Puritan. He preached against witchcraft and led a popular revolt against New England's colonial governor. When Cotton Mather talked, people listened.
There's one thing that Cotton Mather disliked more so than those accused of witchcraft. It's for those who were accused of piracy. He saw this as not so much a law and order issue, but an affront against God himself.
Cotton Mather visited Fly and his crew in jail twice. Someone wrote down the transcripts of those conversations. These are their actual words as they were recorded. Mather opened by telling them to repent of their piratical crimes.
A marvelous providence of God has put a quick stop to a swift career you were taking in the paths of the destroyer. The poor men whom you murdered, you hurried out of the world. You allowed them no space to repent. A gracious God has not so hurried you out of the world, but given you some time to prepare for your death. The robberies and piracies you have committed, you can say nothing to justify them.
Fly's crew confessed almost immediately, but Fly maintained his innocence and blamed another sailor for the killings that set off the mutiny.
I can't charge myself with murder. I did not strike and wound the master or mate. It was Mitchell did it.
What is it in your former life that lies now most heavy upon you? Say, Fly.
My horrid swearing and cursing.
Mather didn't seem convinced that Fly's foul mouth was his worst sin.
Your murders, your horrid and bloody murders.
I can't charge myself.
You held the captain hands down while Mitchell struck him.
No! False oaths have been taken against me.
Miserable man, you know the word of God. No murderer has eternal life, and murders cannot be pardoned if they be not confessed, bewailed, and repented of.
All the pirates repented, except William Fly. He insisted he hadn't killed his former captain, and said nothing about the other murders he was accused of, or, you know, all the stealing. The next morning, Cotton Mather took the pulpit at North Church. All the pirates were in the pews, except William Fly.
A number of dying men appear before us, pirates under sentence of death, and are within a few hours to be executed. It will be the wisdom of us all, but especially our seafaring tribe, to learn from these dying men. Learn from these poor men the mischief of those vices wherein so many of the seafaring tribes suffer the doleful shipwreck of their souls and are downed in perdition. Steer clear of the rocks where you see the breakers before you.
One pirate was given a last-minute reprieve. The rest went to the gallows, including William Fly. Mather had a few final thoughts on him.
He had been all along a most uncommon and amazing instance of impenitency and stupidity. The sullen and raging mood into which he fell upon his first being imprisoned caused him to break forth into blasphemies too hideous to be mentioned.
As William Fly walked up to the gallows, Mather wrote, "The pirate tried to put on a smiling face." Fly had told Mather he wanted people to think he died bravely. but Mather said he noticed Fly's knees shaking.
Now, William Fly seems fairly unrepentant until the very end.
That's Park Ranger Patrick Boyce again.
When he does confront the hangman, he actually harasses the executioner to make sure the rope is tied correctly and actually puts his own head into the hangman's noose.
William Fly wasn't the only pirate to run into Cotton Mather, but it might have been Mather's last encounter with pirates. William Fly was one of the last of the legendary Golden Age pirates. It had become apparent by then this wasn't a very safe career.
William Fly really exemplifies the end of the Golden Age of piracy, and that's in part because of attrition. Between 1716 and 1723, roughly 1,000 pirates are killed, whether it's killed in combat, like Captain Blackbeard, whether it's by execution, like Captain Kidd, whether it's their ships are sunk in a storm, like Black Sam Bellamy. Because if you're acting as a pirate, there's usually no happy ending. One thing or another is going to get you.
At the time of William Fly's death in 1726, there were probably less than 200 active pirates in the Atlantic. Now, pirates didn't go away entirely. Boston had its last pirate execution over a century later in 1835. But the Golden Age of piracy, as historians now define it, was over. But sailors and ships continued to shape America, especially in its port cities. When we come back, stories from the 1800s of lighthouse keepers and whaling voyages and how they're still drawing crowds today. This is Off the Path from WSHU Public Radio, distributed by APM, American Public Media.
I'm Ebong Udama, and I cover Connecticut political news for WSHU Public Radio. Staying well-informed is essential to a well-functioning democracy. Understanding facts and filtering out noise takes work. And our mission at WSHU is to help you do that through coverage from our newsroom, NPR News, and the BBC. We're expanding our world together. Thank you for your support.
This is Off the Path from WSHU Public Radio, distributed by APM, American Public Media. I'm Davis Donovan. Welcome back. One of the most celebrated lighthouse keepers in American history was a woman named Ida Lewis. She lived on an island in Newport Harbor, and starting in the mid-1800s, she became famous for a series of daring rescues in the harbor's choppy waters. It was called Lime Rock Light when Ida Lewis was lighthouse keeper. These days, it's the headquarters of the Ida Lewis Yacht Club in Newport, Rhode Island.
Located in the south side of the harbor of Newport, the inner harbor.
I'm here with Tony Knowles of the Yacht Club. You wouldn't recognize the structure as a lighthouse. There's no tower.
It's a stone-built, brick-built building on lime rocks. It wasn't a lighthouse as you normally know it, with a rotating light on a tower, usually with stripes on, because the light was a fixed light and it was put out here mainly for harbor traffic.
Fort Adams, a coastal army post, was established here in 1799. And then the fishermen came, lots of them, especially lobstermen.
There were several accidents way back in the early 1800s of boats running in the fog onto the rocks.
And then in the mid-1800s, Gilded Age stone mansions began to line the shores of Newport Harbor. We have a panoramic view of them and the rest of the harbor from the building's big bay windows.
And looking north from here, we can see Newport Bridge, beautifully illuminated in the sunlight this afternoon. We can look across at Jamestown, where we can see modern houses and old.
After the mansions went up, the harbor became even more abuzz with traffic, and they decided to build a lighthouse.
Lighthouse keeper was Captain Hosea Lewis, who was Ida Lewis's father.
Captain Lewis moved out to the lighthouse in 1857. He brought his family, including 16-year-old Ida. But just 4 months later, he had a stroke that left him permanently incapacitated.
Then Ida's mother became ill, and so did her siblings. So Ida really took over and became the unofficial keeper.
Every night at dusk, Ida climbed narrow, creaky stairs to an attic room that still looks a little like a chimney from the outside. she carried up a canister of oil and lit a big glass lamp that shone across the harbor. Then she refilled the oil again at midnight. The lamp is on display downstairs.
This is the actual light that was used as a navigation light. It was an oil light.
Would this still work if you were to turn it on today? Or if you were to light it?
Only if there was an oil supply to it.
There was no bridge from the island to the mainland. The only way to get to shore from the lighthouse was in a boat. So Ida rowed her siblings across every day to go to school. Tony Knowles says it was pretty hard for your average teenager to handle a 14-foot boat.
Ida was able to row this, and she'd launch it and row it from a small dock crane and a shed on the dock where she kept all her gear. And if there was an emergency, she would launch the boat, row out, and rescue people as best she could.
She made her first rescue when she was still a teenager, four young men whose sailboat capsized in the harbor. She recalled the story decades later to a reporter. Here's what she said.
I found those four silly boys two-thirds dead, awfully weak and white-faced and almost inanimate. But I got them into my boat somehow. Here, at the light, after we had revived them with stimulants, I scolded them roundly. I said, "You're a pretty quartet. You need a spanking, you do."
More rescues followed over the years, but the rescue that made her famous came during a snowstorm in 1869. Her mother saw a boat capsize in the harbor and called to her daughter. Ida, who had a cold at the time, jumped in her rowboat without a coat or shoes.
She went out in the middle of winter, breaking ice, rowing her dinghy out there, and then pulling sailors into the dinghy.
The Yacht Club has a sketch that was originally published in Harper's Magazine depicting the rescue. It's framed on a wall full of Ida Lewis memorabilia. It shows Ida pulling the sailors from the icy water.
One she's been able to drag into the boat. The second one is hanging onto the side of the boat and she's trying her hardest to pull him into the boat. Of course, there's a lot of waves breaking into the boat at the time, so you can see that in the drawing.
The men she rescued were soldiers at nearby Fort Adams. They'd paid a young boy to row them across the harbor. Sadly, the young boy drowned, but Ida Lewis rescued the sailors and brought them back to the lighthouse.
They spent the night. They were wrapped in wool blankets, sat near the wood stove, and the mother took out the bottle of brandy that she kept just for this purpose and made this concoction of molasses and a little brandy to, like, revive them. And after their clothes dried out and they spent the night, the sergeants were so grateful to Ida, but they had to report it.
And that made the rescue a news story. This is Marion Gagnon. She made a documentary about Ida Lewis.
It just really took off like you wouldn't believe. Kind of like it would today, except that, you know, things were a lot slower.
It started with a write-up in the New York Tribune. Then she appeared on the cover of Harper's Weekly, in the same issue that has that dramatic sketch. The newspapers even gave her a nickname.
The bravest woman in America. She just became like this household name across the country.
At least two songs were published about her in 1869. The Ida Lewis Waltz and this one, the Ida Lewis Mazurka.
She got lots of marriage proposals in the mail, and even one father came to the island and said, "I want you to meet my son and marry him." And she said thank you, but no to all of it. She just wanted to stay in Lime Rock and do her job because she really, really loved the light and taking care of the light. And she always would say, "The light is my child. I know when it needs me."
Ida and her family mostly just seemed amused by it all. Her father spent one summer counting visitors to the island. He counted 9,000 in all, sometimes as many as 600 in a day.
"I used often to have so many callers that I couldn't get my housework done. I shook hands with more people in a summer than the president in Washington."
That's a reading from an interview Ida gave. And speaking of whom, President Ulysses S. Grant did show up on the island too. A newspaper reported he got his feet wet coming ashore and quipped,
"I have come to see Ida Lewis, and to see her, I'd get wet up to my armpits if necessary."
She also got a visit from two women who wanted her to join their cause, suffragettes Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
And they thought, well, here's someone who can really be a role model that young women can look up to and, you know, encourage them to vote. So they came to the island and talked to her and tried to convince her to, like, join the movement. And she absolutely was not interested. And she's quoted somewhere as saying something like, I'd rather do another rescue than spend an afternoon with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony.
Still, Ida faced plenty of sexism in her day, too.
Mostly men who said, what is she doing rowing a boat? How unfeminine is this? And saving people? This is ridiculous. I hope she gets married sometime soon and she can forget all of this nonsense. And but yet other people would say that's just ludicrous. Anybody would be foolish to say such a thing about her. This is like if she could do it. She did it. This was her life. This is what she wanted to do. She wanted to live at the lighthouse and she wanted to help people. And she was completely dedicated to that.
If there were some people out there who needed help, I would get into my boat and go to them, even if I knew I couldn't get back. Wouldn't you?
Much later, toward the end of her life, Ida mused about how the rescues gave her life purpose.
We only have one life to live. And when our time comes, we've got to go. So it doesn't matter how. I never thought of danger when people needed help. Such times you're busy thinking of other things.
In 1879, after decades of lighting the lamp and rescuing sailors, she was finally appointed the official lighthouse keeper of Lime Rock Light. See, up until that point, her parents had technically run the lighthouse. She made her last rescue at the age of 63 and died 6 years later in 1911. No one knows exactly how many people she rescued. She didn't keep records.
Documented were 18 rescues of men.
Tony Knowles of the Ida Lewis Yacht Club, which now sits on the island.
The 18 rescues are now honored by having 18 stars on the Yacht Club flag here.
The lighthouse closed in 1928. A prominent boater immediately bought it and turned it into the Yacht Club.
And here we are, 96 years later, still flourishing.
Maybe you love maritime history, but you don't want to get your feet wet. Maybe you're more into books, like Moby Dick. There's an annual festival for that, the Moby Dick Marathon in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Just in case you missed it in high school, a quick refresher. We follow Ishmael. He's a crew member aboard the whaling ship, the Pequod. Its captain, Ahab, is obsessed with catching a whale called Moby Dick. This book is all about whaling, which used to be one of the most lucrative industries in the world. And it was partially inspired by the author's time in New Bedford. It's where the book opens, too. Ishmael is stumbling down New Bedford's cobblestone streets at night, looking for a room at an inn.
Such dreary streets, blocks of blackness, not houses, on either hand, and here and there a candle, like a candle moving about in a tomb. At this hour of the night, of the last day of the week, that quarter of the town proved all but deserted. But presently, I came to a smoky light proceeding from a low, wide building, the door of which stood invitingly open.
It's the Spouter Inn, where Ishmael's adventure gets set in motion. Melville might have had a similar experience when he came to New Bedford in the winter of 1840 and signed on board a whaling ship.
Well, he was a mariner. I mean, he was a mariner anyway. He was a school teacher for a while. He didn't do very well at that, and he joined a merchant voyage.
That's Michael Dyer of the New Bedford Whaling Museum. He says New Bedford was an intentional choice by Melville. The city was one of the global centers of the whaling trade in the 1800s, along with the island of Nantucket.
It was designed, laid out by a maritime culture to be the ultimate fruition of a maritime culture.
The Whaling Museum is the setting for the Moby Dick Marathon. It's a 25-hour-long reading, cover to cover from start to finish, every single word of the book. It started in the late 1990s. It's not the only annual public reading of Melville's famous work. There were a few others, but it's probably the biggest, and it's the only one that takes place where and when Herman Melville actually set sail.
It's great American literature, which connects to people across the boards. Whether they care about whaling or not, many people actually care a great deal about great literature, and they love Moby Dick.
Over the years, it's taken on an energy more like a festival than a somber book reading. Hundreds of readers take turns reading 10-minute sections of the book from beginning to end.
There are people every marathon who stay awake for the whole 25 hours. They're there for the whole thing. There are people who sleep in the museum. You know, you have to walk over them as you go through the galleries.
There's hot clam chowder for those who stay for the whole thing. Stephanie Claussen hopes to be one of them. She flew in from California for the weekend. This is her first time in New Bedford, but she's done Moby Dick marathon reads in San Francisco. She loves the endurance challenge of it.
I think it must be like people who run marathons. I don't. My sister does. I think you're sort of euphoric and exhausted. I mean, this is slow. This is slow going theater, and you're in it for the long haul. And it does something, I think, just like the book, to your attention span, that stretches it out like a long whaling voyage.
Stephanie and hundreds of others pack into a spacious gallery in the museum. Some sit in chairs, some on the floor, and some sprawl out on board a huge replica of a whaling ship called the Lagoda that takes up most of the room in the gallery. It's so crowded, I'm stepping over people sprawled out on the floor. A lot of them are flipping through their own copies of Moby Dick. A volunteer signals the start with the tolling of a ship's bell, and then it begins.
Call me Ishmael.
After the initial excitement, everyone settles in as readers take turns.
A tramping of sea boots was heard in the entry. The door was flung open, and in rolled a wild set of mariners enough.
It was now quite plain that he must be some abominable savage. A peddler of heads, too. He might take a fancy to mine. Heavens! Look at that tomahawk.
After 10 short chapters, the reading stops, and everyone moves to a church across the street. This is the Seaman's Bethel, and Herman Melville actually came here when he lived in New Bedford. It's the central setting for an early chunk of Moby Dick, too.
New Bedford is a queer place. Had it not been for us whalemen, that tract of land would this day perhaps have been in as howling condition as the coast of Labrador. As it is, parts of her backcountry are enough to frighten one. They look so bony. The town itself is perhaps the dearest place to live in all New England.
Ishmael attends a sermon given by a pastor named Father Mapple. It's all about the biblical story of Jonah and the whale, of course, and it's full of maritime imagery to explain its religious symbolism. After all, Father Mapple would have been preaching to a bunch of sailors. A local pastor reads Father Mapple's sermon from the pulpit, which is shaped like a ship's bow, and the marathon goers join in singing a hymn that appears in Moby Dick. About 6 or 7 hours later, the number of people dwindles from the curious to the serious. At about midnight, a local theater troupe arrives for one chapter that Melville wrote like a play in dialogue.
Well, and adieu to you, Spanish ladies.
They're the sailors of the Pequod, singing and sharing stories on the ship's upper deck, or forecastle. Even fewer people are left now as the night drags on and Captain Ahab continues his relentless pursuit of Moby Dick across the oceans of the world. Spoiler alert, Ahab dies in his attempt to kill Moby Dick, but we never find out if the whale survives. The ship sinks into the sea, and only Ishmael lives to tell the tale. Michael Dyer, whom you heard earlier, reads some of the last words just before the epilogue.
Small fowls flew screaming over the yawning gulf. A sullen white surf beat against its steep sides, then all collapsed, and the great shroud of the sea rolled on.
Michael Dyer carries a beat-up old paperback copy of Moby Dick into our interview.
This was a 1986 edition. So I got this in 1986.
How many times have you read Moby Dick?
I read it once a year.
Do you remember how you fell in love with the book?
Oh, yeah, I distinctly remember. It was a girl who told me I was a Moby Dick person. I was absolutely in love with this girl after high school.
And he's carried it around ever since. I'm pretty new to Moby Dick. I first read it back in 2022. And I've certainly never been on a whaling voyage. But I still get chills when I hear Herman Melville's words in a room full of hundreds of people, including a lot of people in their 20s and 30s who've maybe never been in a boat at all. And we're all sharing in that experience. It's kind of the same feeling when I sing sea shanties with the Ranzo Boys and hundreds of other people in New York City or Essex, Connecticut or Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
A lot of these kinds of songs, like work songs and walking songs and shanties that were used for work, are meant to be sung along to.
The reason those songs are still being sung is because they have a resonance for us today, whether that's I'm in love with this girl, or I hate my boss, or God, it's going to be a long time to get over this mountain.
And there's a song that you sing, Davis, called Pay Me My Money Down, that goes, pay me, pay me, pay me my money down, pay me or go to jail, pay me my money down. And I sing that when people haven't filled my invoices.
They're all so beautiful and profound, and some of them are funny, and what is really special about it is that you are singing them with other people in the present moment, and something funny happens to your brain when you're singing in a room with, you know, 60, 100 people, that just kind of brings you to a higher plane, an older plane, you know, it's really transcendent.
So my last question.
Where did the name Ranzo Boys come from?
So Louisa Jo Killen was a singer in the folk revival of the 60s who was hugely influential, particularly in the world of maritime music. And she came out as a trans woman very late in life.
Did you ever see a wild goose?
A song that she used to sing a lot, one of her sort of signature songs, was the Wild Goose Shanty, which has in it, the refrain is Ranzo, Ranzo.
They're just like them pretty girls when they get the notion. Ranzo, Ranzo, way.
That was the Ranzo Boys, Lafayette Matthews, Jules Pipearl, and Lindsay Smith.
This show was produced and mixed by Sabrina Garone and edited by J.D. Allen. And it's hosted by me, Davis Donovan. I also composed the theme music with additional music by Ellis Light. Fact-checking was done by Eric Warner. Graphic design is by Josh Joseph. You heard the voices of David Tosher, Bill Buckner, Tom Kuser, Samantha Edmonds, and Janice Roman reading from historical texts. The podcast Off the Path is a production of WSHU Public Radio. For more stories from along the Appalachian Trail or northern New England and everything in between New York and Boston, subscribe to Off the Path wherever you get your podcasts or find us at WSHU.org. Thanks for setting sail with us. Off the Path is distributed by APM American Public Media.